Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin, and this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy.
Presented by the Mary Lou Lemon Foundation.
It's highly unlikely the 59th Oklahoma legislature will be long remembered. Its two-session run, which ended last month, was mostly another 2 years of wheel spinning, failing to address the needs or advance the interests of most workaday Oklahomans. If the 59th is remembered for anything, it will be its preoccupation with two SLGBTQ+ folks, especially transgender Oklahomans. This year alone, more than 50 bills were introduced that the American Civil Liberties Union labeled anti-2SLGBTQ+. Fortunately, many never got so much as a hearing, but that was little consolation to our loved ones, friends, and neighbors who don't fit neatly into a Christo-fascist worldview that predominates the Republican legislative supermajority. What did gain traction was open hate speech. Remember Senator Tom Woods publicly referring to 2SLGBTQ+ Oklahomans as filth? And Senator Jessica Garvin's and Representative Tony Hassenbeck's so-called Women's Bill of Rights, essentially Oklahoma's bathroom bill in which lawmakers once again are playing doctor without a license, defining in statute what biological characteristics determine male from female. As we celebrate Pride Month in defiance of this legislative meddling in private lives, we invited Freedom Oklahoma's Executive Director Nicole McAfee to join us for today's ObserverCast to discuss the 59th Legislature's all-out assault on two SLGBTQ+ Oklahomans, how it impacts their everyday lives, and what lawmakers' unbridled bigotry does to our state's national reputation and its hopes for a better future.
Sounds good. It's so good to see you today. Just tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
I'm Nicole McAfee. I use they and she pronouns, and I am the executive director of Freedom Oklahoma, a 2SLGBTQ+ advocacy organization that works to build a future where all queer, trans, and two-spirit folks can thrive across Oklahoma. So, easy work.
Yeah. Yes. Cakewalk in Oklahoma. Tell us a little bit about, you know, we're going to dive into the legislature and what happened this past session, given that it is Pride Month. But, you know, tell us a little bit about, you know, why your organization even has to exist and some of the work that you do.
Yeah. Freedom Oklahoma really came about as an organization around a need for advocacy. When we were seeing marriage equality fights happen at state levels and the start of sort of attempts to ban access to queer marriage, going through state legislatures, moving through ballot questions, there was this need for folks to plug into what's going on in systems that aren't by their nature very easy to access or understand. And so our team at Freedom Oklahoma does a variety of different work to try to meet the needs of people where they're at on the ground, whether that's creating community space, creating space and support for parents and caregivers and educators, as well as tracking policy moving through the legislature. So we annually put together a spreadsheet that's always larger than I would like of all of the bills, bad and a few good, that we are keeping an eye on and that we think people should know about, and do our best to then regularly update that so people can understand where those bills are in the process, what might have changed about them, and how they can plug into any actions or advocacy around any of those pieces of policy that might be moving.
So let's go ahead and dive into session this year. Do you have a recap? I mean it's a little blithe to ask for just a recap, but we'll go into the details.
Yeah, we started off session with sort of more anti-2SLGBTQ plus bills than anyone else in the country. Part of that was that we were in a carryover session where bills from 2023 were still eligible to be heard. But we also just saw sort of a whole bunch of new attempts to attack queer and trans folks. So we'd seen a sports ban move through the legislature. We'd seen trans healthcare bans targeting youth pass. And so we kind of got to this point that it seemed like Oklahoma was a testing ground of sorts for new policy attacks. When the news of Nex Benedict's death became really nationwide news, Nex being a gender expansive youth from Owosso who died the day after being beaten in a school bathroom and after experiencing more than a year of sort of transphobic attacks in school. We saw some slight shifts in legislative priorities. There seemed to be at least some level of understanding that there were a lot of eyes on the legislature and on the anti-2SLGBTQ plus policies and rhetoric coming out of the legislature. And at that point in session, we saw some shifts and a number of bills that had been moving kind of pushed to the side. And so we ended session with less anti-2SLGBTQ plus policy becoming law than we've seen in recent years. And still with, I think, some notable bills advancing, including House Bill 1449, which sort of enshrined Governor Stitt's transphobic EO into statute, as well as some legislation modeled after what's called at the federal level the Kids Online Safety Act, which creates some real potential loopholes for disrupting digital privacy and potentially censoring 2SLGBTQ plus content on the internet.
What was it about this year, you think, that created that momentum, I guess we'll call it, for lack of a better term, to get this onslaught? I know it's an election year, so you have some pandering going on there, but it's just odd to me that all of a sudden Oklahoma became that laboratory, as you described it, for this sort of mischief.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of a few bad things that the Texas legislature wasn't in regular session, and that tends to be one of the other places that we see sort of as a testing ground for a lot of this policy. And I think too that there was just this idea that things would move in Oklahoma, that we've had a legislature willing to advance blatantly unconstitutional policy, that we've had a governor willing to sign on to that policy, and that there hasn't been a lot of, I think, even national coverage around a lot of even some of the worst bills that have moved in Oklahoma, that we largely fly under the radar more than states like Florida or Texas, that are sort of pitched as these testing grounds. And I think that some of the national organs that move this policy look to Oklahoma as a place that they can try things out without it necessarily catching the attention of national orgs or national news outlets.
So does that mean then that now, are these just trial balloons then to test their constitutionality in front of the Supreme Court? Is that the end goal with these, or?
I think that's the end goal with some of these bills. I also think there's always some testing too around like what might move people or what might entice people to get sort of fired up around some of these policies. But a lot of these to a certain extent seem to be a test for like, can you get anti-trans extremists fired up about this as a potential new issue? And so I think that some of this work is testing talking points and testing policy ideas to see if it might be the next thing that catches on in the way that we've seen trans healthcare bans and trans sports bans move across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not. Well,
I just wonder though. Go ahead, Arnold. Sorry.
No. Go ahead, Marianne, because you're going to follow down that line, and I was kind of going to go a different direction a little bit, but go ahead.
Yeah. No. I'm just. You know. Is it? It's just such a. It's just so mean, you know. I mean, it's so mean to like try it out. I don't have to tell you this, of course, but you know, it's just mean to try and use our state, which is, it just seems kind of, Oklahoma just seems very helpless to these tendencies, you know, just in the sense that our legislature, members of our legislature, are just so prone to adopt these tactics and these, you know, this fear mongering, and I'm just, you know, wondering, you know, did we really see that this sector, that did you see that sort of mobilization?
I think around some of the policy that so on House Bill 1449, which was pushed by some national organizations as a women's bill of rights, even though it doesn't outline any rights for women and is pretty clearly mm-hmm. meant to be trans exclusionary, that we saw several different iterations of that move and go dormant, and saw the authors, especially Senator Jessica Garvin, fight to make sure that this got a hearing and passed this year. And that came with sort of some really rampant transphobic folks who would show up to the legislature on those days and cheer this legislation on. And I think that, yeah, some of it isn't an idea that anyone would have had on their own, but when they hear these policy suggestions, it just feeds into some ideology. And I think about, there was a piece of legislation pushed by Senator Julie Daniels this year that would have made it such that strongly held religious beliefs could not be a factor that kept someone from becoming a foster parent or adoptive parent, including if those strongly held religious beliefs were something like someone who believes in so-called conversion therapy. And so we're creating a situation in a state where we know, like in the rest of the country, there's a disproportionate number of youth in the foster care system, who are unhoused because they're queer and trans. We know that it might not be safe mm-hmm. for a lot of youth in the foster care system to be out. And the idea that we could potentially be knowingly putting them into homes where someone might try to subject them to so-called conversion therapy became a really scary thing for me and my team and community to have to worry about. But it also became something that the same folks who have fought to try to create statutory protections for so-called conversion therapy started to rally around as a new and novel idea that hadn't been on their radar previously, but now is probably something that they will talk to candidates and elected officials about going forward.
You have to wonder about people who keep dreaming up stuff like this, because we've kind of gone from the era where there was widespread debate about whether or not you could force a bakery to make a wedding cake, you know, if their worldview was resistant or opposed. And you have this year with Senator Daniels' bill, and there was also a piece of legislation that actually passed the House, but then died in the Senate, if I recall correctly, that would have given those conscientious objections, if you will, to medical professionals to not provide care if they felt so led. Who has the time to sit around and think about, you know, these sorts of things, to come up with new ways to sort of keep, you know, another community in a box? I just don't get it.
Yeah, I I wish they didn't have that time, or that time would be utilized on solving any number of real issues that face a lot of us on the ground. But it, I think, has been terrifying and fascinating in a terrifying way to like watch the evolution of some of these bills and ideas. And I think about, you know, we had legislation that passed out of committee this year that would have in the House that would have made all sex education in Oklahoma schools opt in instead of opt out. It would have completely removed any definition of consent from Oklahoma statute. So not just for sex education standards, but like the definition of consent as it relates to criminalization of folks who engage in non-consensual behavior. And to hear legislators like very seriously move into this discussion space in the year 2024 that schools should not be providing sex education, that what Oklahoma schools provide should become even narrower and even more difficult to access, it's kind of terrifying that we are moving into this space where these ideas that seem so extreme that they should not be anything but laughable when introduced are actually seriously considered and moving out of bodies in our legislature.
Well, it seems to have.
Well, and then, I mean, go ahead, Arnold. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, it seems to, even if a lot of this did not pass this session, it got enough attention and moved far enough along that it seems to be having its intended impact in the broader community. And I say that because I keep thinking back to the recent adoption by the Oklahoma Secondary Schools Activities Association of a new questionnaire that really hones in on private sexuality issues for athletes in this state. I mean, we're seeing that sort of thing. Sort of, others are taking cues from a legislature that's, you know, that's unbelievably preoccupied with all this.
Yeah, and I think it was interesting too to watch the way that the legislature responded to agencies taking on a lot of seemingly sort of legislative power on their own. And we saw, you know, another round of really large administrative rules changes proposed out of the State Department of Education, all approved unanimously, all with very few, if any, members attending any of the public comment hearings around those. And ultimately, the legislature did not take any final action on those. The House Administrative Rules Committee moved policies, but they didn't vote. And as a House floor, and it didn't make it to the Senate, meaning that the governor is going to have the final say on all of these administrative rules. And to see, I think, that space ceded to agencies, and to then create the scenario where if you are queer and trans, like if you are part of a community that has been historically marginalized and is a current target of sort of extremist policy, you now not only have to pay close attention to what's happening at the legislature, but also what's happening at all of these boards across the state. It becomes, I think, just a pretty horrific prospect to think about how much harm can be done in ways that are really inaccessible for people to even begin to sort of catch it or understand it as it's moving along.
It's, I mean, not to be too abstract and theoretical, but it's a really good reminder of all the ways that we are governed. And it doesn't just come from the legislature, right? And so all the ways that, you know, the legislature is just the start, right? Writing statute is just the start of being governed. And these agencies, particularly when they are run by appointees of an ideologue governor, you know, that the rules really start to take shape of the way that they can implement their agendas. So yeah, it is really horrifying because you think of, you know, the health, the Department of Health and birth certificates, right? You think of, you know, Department of Education with, you know, Walters at its helm and these rules. I mean, they seem so esoteric and kind of like high-minded. And if I think if you've never worked in the legislature, you never get an idea of how, you know, powerful the rules process is. But I remember one legislator, Mike Shelton, telling me, he's like, you do everything through rules, right? You can rule everything if you can control the rules. And so just the minutia of that is where they really have the impact, because that's where you get the real yes or no, or you get into the granular detail of how these laws take shape for the real lives of people. So, I mean, it is interesting then that they ceded it back to the governor by not, you know, approving or disapproving the rules. And again, it's so cerebral, you know, because no one thinks of the rules as a problem. But then you realize that's really how, you know, these terrible things are going to take shape and become the power of law through the rules process.
Yeah, I think about, I've attended State Board of Education meetings pretty regularly since I started at Freedom Oklahoma. It was a mm-hmm. space where I knew that a lot of policy that impacted kind of our most vulnerable community members was happening. And
yeah,
even as recently as this last month, we had a group of different students sort of from some different community orgs across Tulsa who came to the meeting because it was right after school got out. And it was so interesting to hear from them just how sort of horrified they were at witnessing what was happening in that meeting firsthand. The way that, you know, there was another new set of rules around public comment where they've limited who can speak, and now they do a random drawing to determine who gets to speak. They hold the meeting in a really small room where most people can't sit. So most of the students I was sitting with, we were in an overflow area, and there were five troopers who were watching just our overflow area. There were, you know, kids who asked, and like older kids who asked if someone would walk to the bathroom with them because they were worried that they were going to get arrested in this building for going to the bathroom during this public meeting. And I think that just kind of the environment in which all of these rules and policies are decided has gotten a lot more hostile. And that maybe one of the reasons Oklahoma is this testing ground is because we have so few spaces where the public can get involved. You know, we have a legislature where there isn't public testimony mm-hmm. as part of the process, something that oftentimes horrifies people I talk to who are paying attention to Oklahoma for the first time, you know, from a national org or from out of state, and say, what do you mean that the public can't give testimony? And to see even sort of these agency spaces really shut down, room where people can talk on the record, I think just speaks to kind of the larger environment we are seeing that allow these extremist sort of rules and bills to move forward.
And, you know, I just thought of it. You know, I think part of the goal too is to bury it in the rules, in the part where people, you know, and to bury it in the weeds, you know, the part of the whole process that just seems to be very much in the weeds and wonky, and yet holds so much power to make people's lives miserable. You know, and that is yet another way to kind of obfuscate the process in a part of the process that a lot of people are like, oh, what's that? And also, you know, who has the time? Like the people, you know, who might come and comment, who has the time? But also these last minute, you know, how many things were introduced last minute, the whole sleight of hand, you know, dark of night sort of things that happen with the legislature. You know, if it wasn't something to hide, they could do it in daylight.
Yeah. Yeah. The number of bills that, you know, we were lucky to get 24 hours notice were being heard seemed yeah. to be higher than yeah. usual this year, where it was lots of last minute agendas. And it's so hard for people to feel like they have time to even begin to comment and like reach out to legislators. And I think it feels disheartening too, because they understand that like legislators haven't had the time to really look through these agendas and understand the bills in depth. That, you know, I hear from people who have reached out to the representative or senator, and they said, like, this person didn't know what this bill is. They were told to vote on it one way or another by like someone else in their caucus, and they didn't understand like all of these really fine details that I tried to point out to them. And it was hard to have a meaningful conversation about that, because like they clearly hadn't read through all of it, and it's impossible to read through, you know, hundreds of pages of text when you're getting agendas for, you know, two committees you're on at the last minute, plus floor session information. And so it's, I think it's so frustrating just to see that even as there are these pushes for, you know, budget transparency and more information ahead of time, that like the best they could do was promise 24 hours advance notice for budget bills. And that's something we're not afforded on every other bill. And I think that that's a less than ideal way to make policy.
So as a practical matter, what is it like to be in this space in Oklahoma, and to try to navigate and operate with the constant attacks that are coming from the legislature, and this whole attempt to isolate and create others, and you know, what's the practical impact in the daily lives, do you think, of your fellow travelers who are just, they want to be all that their creator intended for them to be. They don't want to have to clear these hurdles all the time and be under attack.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's no monolithic experience, but there are a lot of shared experiences that I hear of. Even as someone who, you know, I find myself really lucky to be in community with a lot of queer and trans people, that I am in Oklahoma City where I can access a lot of community resources. And when I am feeling like isolated or alone in this work, I can go like talk to and physically share space with queer and trans folks. But hearing all of this negative rhetoric, I think really, like, it still gets to me, and it breaks my heart to think about queer and trans youth across the state who don't feel like they have safe spaces to test out who they are or to share in community or even voice when things are targeting them and are hard. And it becomes more difficult as their peers begin to sort of parrot rhetoric that they are hearing from adults in power. And I think that one of the things that is really special about this work to me is the ability to sort of still practice hope, and to do that in community with other people in particular. I went up to the Capitol when there was so much movement happening in response to House Bill 4156, the piece of legislation attacking undocumented immigrants, and some people, you know, like acted surprised that I was there. And I said, you know, there are undocumented people in my community. There are queer and trans people who are undocumented. And that like liberation happens together and collectively. And those were, I think, such special spaces to be in with folks and just see the community.
Well, that's a first. Hang with us here on our high tech.
It happens.
Yeah, well,
that is exactly how long it took for me to get my computer to log on.
Wow.
So, sorry about that. I didn't think it'd be so disruptive. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. Well, hello again.
It's now, Nicole, for you to just to pick right up in your stream of thought there so that we can
I'm
just
so sorry, you guys.
No, yeah. No, you're fine. But yeah, I think that it has been really tough on trans and two-spirit and queer communities. And also I've seen so much community built out of a lot of this hostility. I see so many more like parents and guardians and educators like come together to try to figure out how they better show up for trans and queer young people in their lives. And that those are the things that sort of, even as this hostility seemingly grows more extreme, I think really give me some hope in the importance of sharing out this information and keeping people plugged in. And just being sort of reminded that none of us have to solve any of this alone.
So, you know, I'm thinking of like there's so many contradictions built into these bills, you know, in terms of the Women's Bill of Rights, and yet they want to remove consent, and you know, all that we're supposed to be scared of, you know, transgender men disguising as women, but you know, we don't really care about rape and consent, et cetera, et cetera. But then, you know, I'm just thinking of the kids who, you know, will be in school in August, you know, in these very vulnerable communities, and you know, schools are such a fraught experience, full of, you know, friends and foes. You know, so I'm just wondering what kind of guidance you might provide, you know, for parents of these students, or just the students themselves. You know, how can they navigate that? But then I'm also thinking of the teachers who want to, you know, watch out for these kids. And I frankly, I personally have a hard time thinking that, you know, this, I mean, you know, I want to be an advocate for public schools, and yet I also worry very much about what kind of environment that is, you know, for students, because of the teachers, you know, and because of the administrators, not, you know, not in spite of them. You know, so what are some of your thoughts on how to navigate that terrain for, you know, caregivers, guardians, parents, students, but also, you know, some of the educators who will be in these locations, and how they can best kind of help students that are very vulnerable?
Yeah, I think just first, I will plug Freedom Oklahoma hosts monthly virtual community groups, including one sort of for educators and folks who work in school environments, one that is focused on sort of parents, guardians, and caregivers, and people who serve in those roles to youth, and then one that is a youth-focused space. And so part of that is, as people need to work on, like, real things they are trying to tackle in real time, or for people who just need some community and trying to figure this out together, that all of those links to sign up are regularly on our Freedom Oklahoma events page on our website. I think the other things I would say is that, like, there is always power in numbers, and that for people who feel vulnerable as educators or as parents, that youth are much more vulnerable, and are asked to be much more brave every day. I think that people can do a lot of good by, like, showing up in local decision-making spaces, that, like, going to school board meetings is not a flashy, fun affair. Like, most of the time, those agendas are not super
dry. Exciting. Yes. Dry as wheat toast. Yes.
Yeah. But that really just, like, important decisions can be made there. And a lot of these policies being pushed by the State Department of Education require local boards to implement these rules somehow, and that people showing up, like, from the community, whether you have kids in the school district or you are just someone who is, like, concerned about queer and trans youth in that space, that, like, that's a really important space where folks can show up and dig in and create discussion and awareness. There is no state law currently that requires local board of education meetings to be streamed anywhere. So some people can watch those online from places, but some folks, like, that isn't accessible. And so even people taking the initiative to go live stream those meetings or live tweet what is happening at their local school board meeting to help get the word out. But like all of those can be really powerful actions folks can take. And I think that it's important too, that we're encouraging people to take those actions, even in spaces that they assume are safe or districts that they assume are safe. I've heard, you know, friendly school board members who suggest that, like, oh, well, we aren't enforcing that policy. And I know that that doesn't mean much when it comes to a local administrator who is, or when it is teachers or support staff who are trying to fight against some of that harm at their school. And so I think the more we can kind of create safety for people to push back and create a regular presence in some of these spaces, like, the better reinforced protections are for young people who are sort of most vulnerable to these policies and are increasingly the targets of more and more of these policies, while having the least say in any of these policies or any of sort of who is representing them at a state or local level.
Yeah, I'd have to think in this environment that it is, there are a lot of educators who would be natural allies and who are aware of what's going on in their students' lives and want to be advocates, want to encourage, want to help them navigate through pretty choppy seas, have to be looking over their shoulders to a degree, wondering when Ryan Walters and company are going to come for their certificates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think about, I mean, even when we saw what ultimately became single-sex bathroom restrictions pass through policy at the state legislature, it started when Ryan Walters was a candidate and found that Stillwater Public Schools had had gender-affirming bathroom policy in place for more than a decade without any issue. And he, you know, drove OCPA people from Oklahoma City down to speak at those meetings in Stillwater and to rally some local folks to disrupt those policies from going into effect. And as tough as those meetings were to witness, it also were, like, we saw Stillwater community show up and figure out, you know, where to make community gender and sexuality alliance space off campus, since hosting that on campus was becoming more dangerous, especially for students who didn't want to be outed. And so I think that ideally we would never have to face any of these, like, how do we do these things that should be natural parts of the school experience outside of school, but that really trying to come together and figure out kind of how we solve for some of this harm while it is allowed to exist, is both something that's really, like, empowerful and impactful in terms of being reminded you're not doing this alone and creating some space and community together. And I think is just helpful in community building for work across the board. Because it's, right, it's in these local school board elections where we see these, a lot of extremists kind of first get elected or at these more local level seats, and they then run for the state house or state senate. And I think if we are pushing back at the most local levels, to some extent, we're kind of disrupting some of these assumptions and also this bench of future candidates who might be trying to push more of this type of policy.
I guess I want to believe in the better angels of a lot of our legislators. It's just hard for me to imagine that a lot of these folks aren't simply going along and voting, even though they're personally opposed to these things, because it's just sort of the easier course of action for them. And they're concerned about saving their political careers in a lot of cases, or they fear what could happen to their political careers if they stand up. Is there are there things that you see that allies could be doing to help bolster the backbones of folks who are being sort of run over by the noisiest elements in the far right world, in a way that could bring us back to a healthier space with our public conversation in Oklahoma?
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of ways that like allies have been and can show up differently. And I think some of it even sort of starts like within the space of presumed allies that, the number of times I've been in the building and heard Representative Turner misgendered or sort of talked about indirectly in such a way that violates the rules of decorum, but not heard any of even their colleagues in the Dem caucus like speak up. Like that is a space where for these folks who rely on this idea of camaraderie across the aisle and, think of themselves as buddies with some of these folks that if they disrupted like that harm on a regular basis, if there wasn't tolerance for that within friendly conversation, like on the floor, that I don't think it leads to more hostility, but I do think it like puts folks in some space where they have to think about like their friendships and how easy it is for them in the building if they continue to act that way. That I think we can do a lot of work like starting within Dem caucuses to create more space so that like the Representative Turners of the world don't get like burnt out of that role, because we've heard from so many constituents like how important it has been to see someone like them in office. And I always wonder like what it would have been like for them to be more supported in that role, sort of not just by community, but by people in the building. And so I think that there's definitely some work that can start there. I think that people, especially folks who aren't directly impacted, have an important role to play in like having some of these conversations with legislators, like in district, especially, while they're out of session and they might be at home, like setting up a coffee or a meeting at your local church and talking about like why it is important to you that they stop attacking queer and trans kids, that they stop attacking public education, goes a long way, because I think especially because there's not this public testimony, there's this idea that like queer and trans people only exist in Oklahoma City and Tulsa and maybe Norman. And I know the latest data from the Williams Institute, which just estimates the number of like queer and trans adults. It doesn't even begin to like get into youth. Like if we all lived in one place, we would be the third largest city in the state. And that's something I think about often, that like there are a lot of queer and trans folks, and we are all over the place, like not just concentrated in urban areas. And so I think that like people having those conversations, like especially where it feels hard with people, is important, and that it's important for like trans people to not always have, queer people not always to have to be the ones that engage folks in that conversation, who are policymakers and decision makers. And I think too that there are a lot of people who have built these kind of like nice guy reputations on being moderate and friendly, who are like presumed to be okay on these issues, or that they must speak back on these, talk back on these issues and then vote with the rest of their colleagues when, a transphobic piece of legislation comes before them, and that like they should be prime targets too. And I think of like Representative Pei voted for House Bill 1449, and I think about how often like he is the I'm a reasonable guy sort of model that, Dems take pictures with, and that the people in lot say is okay. But like when it comes to moments of political courage, that like those folks aren't there yet. And it's because they don't think that anybody is paying attention, or at least no one is asking them about their votes there. And that it's really important that people dig into that work, even if some of the beginning of the work is like sitting in some discomfort with people that like we think we have a friendly relationship with.
That kind of dovetails with what you were saying about the, you know, about the surprise when you showed up at the rally in opposition to the Show Me Your Papers bill. And people were like, you know, why are you here? Well, you know, I mean, we share a lot of common ground, and it shouldn't be, you know, that should rise above everything else. Understanding that groups are not monolithic, but you know, you would think that it would be natural for groups across the board to sort of work together on those things. And you would also think, when you're talking about the community being the third largest, basically, community in Oklahoma, that, and I realize not all are voting age. Well, I'm not sure what the study, if it only looked at adults, but boy, it sure seems to me that that's a powerful political force that could begin to send a message if you could get people organized and you could target strategically the resources that, you know, the worst offenders could be, a message could be sent that would put a stop to a lot of this and begin to, again, move the state back to a healthier place. Well, a place that it's never been, probably, actually, but...
You know, I'm thinking though, like, about Martin Luther King Jr. saying, you know, his greatest concern were the white moderates, not the extremists, you know? I don't know, this is really making me think hard about how little political courage there is, overall. And I guess, you know, I'm obligated to say, you know, Representative Maureen Turner, of course, she, you know, they tried to advance legislation. Representative Regina Goodwin has tried to advance legislation. You know, George Young, I mean, there's bills that have been, you know, tried to move. And so, you know, Democrat people with a D by their name, you know, have certain limitations to what they can get done. But at the same time, I think it's definitely something for all of us to sit and think about in terms of ways that we have been complicit instead of not being strong enough advocates for those, because I have no doubt that what Representative Turner went through, you know, being not just the only Democrat, but being Representative Turner on the state's rights committee, you know, I mean, just the problem with that, the vulnerability of that moment, you know, it speaks volumes, I think, for the state of things. And I think that should always be a moment like that. This is just a reminder that we all need to really sit and think about and reflect on our role in this. And if not, pushing back stronger and doing what we can in these instances.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah, I think,
oof.
Yeah. It is not like comfortable to sit with, but I think about back sort of even to the day where the situation happened that led to Representative Turner's censure. And I was there like with a trans person, and we were working, you know, their partner just got arrested. They were not under arrest, and police were trying to like force them to have a conversation. And Representative Turner knew from doing lots of Know Your Rights trainings with the ACLU of Oklahoma that like they did not have to talk to police. They were under no obligation as someone who was not actively under arrest. And like as security and as troopers were like trying to harass this person and trying to harass Representative Turner, like none of their colleagues came to check on them, right? Like came to create some like barriers between these troopers who very much were not showing any respect to like both this like trans woman who was in Representative Turner's office or to Representative Turner. You know, no one else came to help figure out like bail for this neurodivergent trans man who had been taken to Oklahoma County Jail for like being in a moment of very understandable meltdown after like his access to life-saving medical care was being attacked. While the members like generally condemned the censure, and I think the Dem caucus fundraised off of it, like no one talked about a follow-up know your rights around being in a situation where police are trying to pressure you to talk to them even though you don't have to. No one talked about the like reality that, you know, the narrative Representative Turner was housing a fugitive like was untrue, as we were talking about someone who was not actively under arrest, that it was sort of all of that narrative was allowed to happen. And I think even in the context of like national narrative at that point, there was a lot of focus on legislative members who were being censured or removed in other states, like in Tennessee and I forget now whether it was Montana or Wyoming, because it has been a while. Like there was a trans legislator, Black legislators who were censured that got a lot of national news. And I think it becomes a lot more difficult when you're talking about someone like Maury, who like doesn't fit neatly in a box, who is Black and trans non-binary and Muslim, and like the narrative isn't as easy, and that we all like collectively have some responsibility to dig into that work, knowing that we like can't change those narratives alone or overnight, but that we can do a lot better in asking one another like how we are showing up, because especially like after that, asking trans people to be in the building became a lot scarier for me. Like I knew that anytime I go into the building, I regularly have a small posse of troopers who like follow me around when I check in at, you know, I go through security. They ask if more of me are going to be there today, like if there are going to be more trans people in the building. And that is,
oh, Nicole.
Yeah. Like the reality of anytime I think about asking other trans and queer people to show up to the building, like knowing that that is what they can expect. And so I think that there's a lot we can do to just fight back against some of that assumed hostility, and even some of the like assumptions of what spaces aren't threatening, and work to like actively create room for community.
I mean, and what does it mean that the one place that's supposed to be the people's house is the most threatening to this pop, you know, to this community, where, you know, the trans community is viewed as the threat. In a place that, you know, touts its open carry laws and, you know, it's, you know, I mean, just all of this, like they are not interested in protecting people from the real threats in society. And so they conjure all these other boogeymen. And so to be treated like that, but honestly, I'm just really kind of grappling with the idea if our legislature isn't proud of the fact that we escape notice on the national level, you know, that they can do these things without notice, like happened in Tennessee, you know, with the legislators there, because I mean, it's interesting to think that, you know, they kind of, you know, pumped the brakes a little bit after next Benedict's death. So I just don't know, like, if anyone would actually just pay the attention to us a little bit longer, you know, maybe some of these things would cease if they're getting away with it because, you know, mom's not paying attention, or you know what I mean, like,
I think it's possible. And I think even in like the floor debate around another iteration of the like so-called Women's Bill of Rights, it was a bill from last year that had moved and then stalled in the Senate. And so Senator Garvin was able to move that after her new iteration of this bill did not, you know, meet deadline requirements this year. And like someone asked her about, you know, you pulled this from a committee agenda and a committee you chaired. because you said like Nex Benedict just died and I'm going to show the community like some respect by not hearing this bill. But like the fact that there's, you know, an expiration date on that is wild.
Right,
and,
right,
like,
right. Like
the
there's
community
a mourning
is not,
period or something.
Yeah. Oh, that respect.
An embargo for a brief little embargo.
Like, oh, well, we're 6 weeks out now, but it seemed more than anything. It was like, oh, well, the like national media has left. Like people aren't
right
as actively paying attention. And I think that I can pass this now and not face repercussions for like moving legislation that I obviously realized is transphobic enough that I understood it would be harmful to hear in the week following news
Right.
of
I mean,
his death.
So Garvin got it. Like Garvin understood the implications of this legislation, and the people that voted for it clearly understood its implications. But they wanted to wait till no one was paying attention again. You know, which I feel like suggests even more that this really isn't a problem, right? If it's a problem, then you'll handle it. But it's a gesture and it's, you know, shadow boxing. God,
but doesn't it seem like all these shenanigans just simply cement Oklahoma's reputation nationally as a sort of a backwater, not just a mere flyover, but a state that, you know, has a lot of bigotry, a lot of religious-based bigotry, and that it's going to be what it always is, you know, it always has been.
Well, and I want to
and
add,
that's,
like, I also want to include in that because there's other discussions around, you know, besides just LGBTQ rights being stripped, you know, there's other issues like the way our legislature took up issues around DEI, what the governor has done with his executive order. I think it's all too easy, you know, for people in positions of power to say, oh, well, I guess we're not going to do it then, right? Or, you know, to like clamp down on these, to make these laws, to remove offices that deal with DEI issues. But also, I think it's just, for me, it's a very stark reminder that if there weren't some federal protections in place for any of this, how much more they would do, right? And so does that make sense? Like, the only way we have any protections at all for, you know, protected classes is because of the federal government. For now, the Sit administration, or not, sorry, oh, the Trump administration. Oh God, strike those words from my mouth. But you know, I mean, he did some damage, right? In like the EEO protections and all that sort of stuff. But like, it is, and I think of the Voting Rights Act, and you know how the Roberts Court rolled back some of those. I mean, it's so precarious. But if we didn't at least have some federal protections, there would probably be no protections at all in this state for any of these groups.
Yeah, and I think it's like important to lift up too that there are still people who are like selected to be sort of on the chopping block at the federal level. That I think about, you know, immigrant communities right now in particular, that Biden just pushed some policies that like Trump tried and failed to enact, targeting folks seeking asylum and people at the border. And so I always worry about
this
that.
Is all too precarious, all too precarious.
But I think too,
I mean, I'm
like,
sorry, go ahead, Nicole.
Just that there is this like view from far away, like people who are just looking at kind of top line headlines that, you know, Oklahoma must be this awful bigoted place. But the thing that gives me the most hope is that, like, when I talked to people who came on the ground after Nex's death, right, like some of the national orgs who were trying to figure out how to plug in and give youth in particular resources, some of the reporters who came to cover stories, who are always a little like just taken aback by like the kindness they encounter, by like how many queer and trans folks they run into. I just this last weekend spent the weekend in Ponca City for Sunny Days Mural Festival, where like a lot of the muralists are queer and gender expansive, right? That it supports women artists and people marginalized by gender, but that like it was this whole kind of downtown tank over Ponca City to like paint 30 new murals by people with all of these different marginalized identities. And the like overall environment was just really joyful. And we talked to so many people who lived in Ponca City who were so excited about all of this new art that they were getting and all of these people who were there experiencing Ponca City and all of the people that they got to meet through this. And I think it is like those spaces that do give me some hope that we can change this narrative, and that like if we can get people to pay less attention to the like very few folks in power who don't represent a lot of Oklahomans' views, and pay more attention to and engage Oklahomans kind of at the ground level, that there's a lot of space to disrupt some of these narratives, and I think in the long term hopefully disrupt some of this harm.
Yeah, I mean, I think if there was more long-term, like you say, disruption, you know, disruptive conversations with folks in these communities confronted with the idea that their viewpoint is wrong and hurtful, God, I mean, not just hurtful, harmful, you know, dangerous. I think we might, I think, you know, so many communities are still very cloistered, you know, in our state. And I think they're aging. but I don't know. It would be great for Oklahoma to not be in the news for all the worst reasons for just a minute. You know, but also I think before we go, because I know we all have not forever tonight. You know, I do want to take a moment and you know, celebrate queer joy and you know, and just the beauty and the wonder of the community, and of our friends, family, and you know, neighbors who are a part of the community. You know, for all that they're worth and all that they add and contribute to the world around us. I mean, so personally, thank you, Nicole, for the work that you do, because my God. Oh my God, like you carry so much of this. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. We wrap up legislative session every year and go right into Pride. And as much as I would sometimes like a week to decompress and take a break, because I think it's always so beautiful to like get to spend so much of June out in community with queer and trans people across the state. You know, I'm going to Tahlequah for their first ever Two-Spirit Symposium.
Oh, fantastic.
We're having a table at Latin Pride Prom. You know, we'll be all over the place getting to chat with queer and trans people and like just getting to share in some of that joy. And so I think that as much as talking about legislative session can really get everyone feeling a bit down, that it is nice to have that reminder too, that, you know, it is Pride Month, and there is a lot of joy to be had and shared.
And love. Joy and love. So thank you, Nicole. Thank you so much for your time today. I'm glad we could catch you. I hope you have a wonderful June and a restorative off season.
Get that battery recharged.
Absolutely. Yeah, may it be gentle. Have a good evening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ObserverCast. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us and share our episodes far and wide on social media. If you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, please give Arnold Hamilton a call at 405-478-8700 or drop him an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org. You can also support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, whose mission is to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. And to help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the Donate button on the upper right side of the homepage. We also urge you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in its 55th year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. We have a special digital subscription rate for ObserverCast listeners, only $1.99 a month for the first year. That's 50% off the usual rate for monthly digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate. And finally, we want to thank Jared Deck for the music you're listening to in the background here. He's not just a resident of Norman anymore. He is now the Oklahoma State Representative for House District 44. Congratulations, Representative Deck. We're so proud of you. But you can still download his albums at iTunes and learn more, including dates for any upcoming performances at jareddeckmusic.com.